The farm sale. The generally accepted and most popular way of quitting farming has historically been to hold an auction. In the state of Colorado, if you are truly quitting, the auction is not subject to sales tax. However, if you are just trying to get rid of a bunch of unwanted junk, antiques, and not really ceasing operation, then tax must be collected. Work goes on for days ahead of the sale, getting everything lined up and in the proper location. There is an unwritten code that is followed religiously in lining things up for sale, all the small stuff on the wagon, larger miscellaneous items lined up in rows, with room between the rows for the crowd to stand. Household goods and related items near the house, with small items on the tables for all to see. The machinery and vehicles in their own row. The junk wagon is always the first thing sold. The name here can be a misnomer, as on this wagon are usually all of the hand tools that operated the farm, sometimes running into many dollars of valuation. There will be spare parts for tractors, cars, and equipment. There may be new supplies consisting of new baling twine, or grease or oil, or other farming supplies. There will always be some buckets of old bolts and washers. There will be boxes of you name it, and you can have it for $1. Years ago, when the horse was used for power, harness was sold on the wagon. All sorts of bridles, halters, collars, and harness sets were sold. Then came the age of the tractor, and one could hardly give harness away. Now, however, things have reversed since there are so many horse owners, and harness, or at least related items, are once again sold. They call it tack now, and it brings more money than it used to when people depended on it for their living. The sale begins at 10 a.m. The auctioneer usually starts off with a brief statement about the auction, and the owner's reasons for holding it. There is usually some element of truth in this announcement, however, he is always very careful to present the sale items in a most favorable light. Having said this, he usually starts his chant with, "Well, all right, sir, what do you want to give for it?" Holding up the first item that is handed to him, and so, the sale begins. He usually has one or two helpers on the wagon handing him items and taking bids. Down in the crowd, the object is to make a bid as unobserved as possible. A bid may be a slight nod of the head, or a slight movement of the hand, or just one finger, or sometimes just a change of facial expression. Bid watchers have to be alert to all these things. Once the wagon is sold, they usually move on to the household items. The small items are sold first, then they move on to the larger appliances and furniture. If it is not a large sale, the auctioneers usually take a short break for lunch. However, if they feel that there isn't sufficient time, they will take turns eating and continue on with the sale. The Ladies' Aid, or the Woman's Club, or other organizations in the community, seize the opportunity to serve the lunch to bolster their treasury. At least that used to be true, and the person holding the auction furnished the coffee. This isn't the case so much anymore, as more often than not, there will be a lunch wagon operated by a person who specializes in such occasions. The next things sold are usually miscellaneous items that were too large for the wagon. It might be fencing, posts, lumber, or some other thing. In fact, just about anything that is left to sell, that is not considered machinery. The machinery starts to sell, and the rule of thumb is save the best for last. So it goes, smaller older machinery first, and ending up with tractors at the last. Tractors are always started, and moved a short distance to prove that they will do just that, and reversed to show that gear also works. The sale is always made to the highest bidder, but there was a time during World War II, that this wasn't true. Prior to the sale, the auctioneer submitted a list and description of tractors and combines, and motor vehicles to the Office of the Price Administration. This office established a ceiling price for the item, based upon the condition. Buyers interested at the ceiling price were encouraged to put their name in a hat, and a drawing was held to see who the lucky person was, who got the machine. Livestock is not sold much anymore at farm auctions. There are usually no facilities for weighing at the farm site, therefore most cattle are sold through regular livestock arenas, in sale barns. However, if the man chooses to sell his cattle at the sale, and by the head instead of hundredweight, they are the last thing sold. I think that sale day must be a traumatic experience for the person having the sale. Most times, they are watching an accumulation of things of a lifetime being sold. He watches as some of the things he valued the most, and thought should bring a good price, are sold for very little. Then on the other hand, things that he thought would not sell well, bring sometimes a fabulous price. It is a good way to dispose of everything, however, as everything goes, even though the price may be small. Sales sometimes draw huge crowds, but probably only a small fraction of the people are buyers. Many go just to visit with the neighbors, and to see things sell. They are caught up in the excitement of the event. The auctioneer's chant is a delight to listen to, and his ability to do this well is a definite asset to the sale. The chant consists mostly of repetition of words, with a few cliches and pat phrases that he uses. He will begin with,
"Well, all right, sir. What do you want to get for it? Gimme a dollar, gimme, one gimme, one gimme, one gimme a dollar bill, I got one now, gimme a half, gimme 50, gimme a half. I got a dollar 50 now, make it two. Mighty fine old pitchfork here. Gimme $2, I've got a dollar 50 now, make it two, gimme two, gimme two, gimme two, you're out, sir. Gimme two, I got 150 now, gimme two, are you all through? Gimme 75, I got 50 now, make it 75, gimme me 75, all done, all gone, gimme 75, sold."
Sold to the man in the straw hat, for $1.50. Yes, the farm sale is the traditional way to go out of the farming business, and though there are some changes in procedure, many things about it still stay the same. Some of the women always find the chairs that are to be sold, and sit there and visit. The kids always run around the place, just enjoying, in general, the being there, and caught up in the excitement of the crowd. Part of the crowd will be at the place where the selling is going on, but there are always people looking at other things that will sell later, or just standing and visiting. One of the standard questions at a sale is, "Did you buy anything?" And the most common reply is, "Nope. Just my lunch."
Hello, can you hear?
The International Farm All Age. Grandpa Gresham decided that he needed a tractor in 1940, so he ordered a Farm All C from Elsner Farm Equipment. The tractor didn't come in, but a Farm All Age did, a much larger and more powerful tractor. The dealership talked him into taking the H, as there was no indication when the C might come in. It was a plain Jane, no starter or lights, the power to the spark plugs was supplied by a magneto, no hydraulics, and it had to be cranked to start the engine. It was wonderful, and we all loved it. I learned to drive it and pull a two-bottom plow. Alan also learned to drive it, however later as he was only 6 at the time. The tractor stayed in our family until I traded it off for a grain drill, after moving to the farm in 1965. After World War II, the Elsner dealership expanded with a remodeled building, and a more complete stock of parts. The first tractor sold by the dealership was a 1946 Farm All Age. It was sold to Richard Cole, and used by him until he quit farming. I don't know who all owned the tractor after that, Willard Peterson was one of them, and Alan Gresham was the person that I bought it from. The tractor sits in my barn today, and has been partially restored to be repainted. It still runs, the tires are good, having been replaced not too many years ago. My most recent use of it was running a saw, to saw up lumber from tearing down the old house. Helene always knew of my fondness for the H, and in fact, she drove it for me as I fed the group of sheep that we had at one time. While working for the fire department as the secretary, she took a month's salary, and adding to it, bought an exact replica of a Farm All Age, and gave it to me. The price was outlandish, but she didn't care. My love of the tractor, and her love for me, made it okay. The tractor sits in a prominent place in the hutch in our dining room, one of my most cherished possessions. July 8, 2020.
Hello, can you hear?
Dirt Roads. Jim and I were discussing a title for this book, and one of the suggestions was, Dirt Roads and Wooden Fences. We never had much in the way of wooden fences, but we sure had the dirt roads. The dirt road still goes by my place, however it is graveled, and maintained to a degree, though it is still very dusty. With a subdivision just south of here, there are hundreds of cars each day on it now. We never even look up when cars go by, but it was not that way when I was a kid, we always looked and waved, because it would be one of the neighbors. In the 30s and 40s there was no gravel on the road by here, and much of the time there were deep ruts, that cars would straddle when it was dry enough to do so. Sometimes, they just got into the rut and hoped they would make it. My cousin Marjorie's wedding was on a Sunday in August of 1945, an evening event. That afternoon, there was a very hard rain, so the road was impassable. Dad rolled his pant legs up over his overshoes, and our whole family walked the 3/4 of a mile to the graveled road. Our car may have been there from a previous event, or we might have caught a ride on into the church in Elbert, I can't remember which. After the wedding, a reception was held in the basement of the church, and there was Dad, with his pant leg still rolled up. Our family still laughs about that. Though they are graveled and maintained now, most of the roads west of Elbert are still dirt roads. The roads north and south of Elbert are now paved, and see a lot of traffic. November 25, 2020.
Hello, can you hear?
Editor's note. This story was written by Mom around the time the new barn was built, but I'm sure Dad was a source of at least some of the information. History of the Gresham Barn. 1901-1983. By Helene Gresham.
George Gresham built the barn in the fall of 1901. While he was finishing the roof, a strong wind came up and blew it off, so he had to start over. This time, he He used plenty of nails. He built a hayloft that was useful, not only for storing hay, but also for kids to play in, and a place where cats could hide their kittens. In the early 1930s, Frank Gresham built an addition to the south side of the barn. He installed a cement floor and stanchions so he could milk cows. Even after 50 years, this was called the new barn. In 1956, Alan Gresham upgraded the milking barn to a Grade A milking barn. He poured a new cement floor and installed a milk cooler, partitioning off the east side for a washing and cooling room. After Warren Gresham and family bought the family farm in 1965, the barn was used for lambing, shelter for livestock, and milking a few cows. During the hard winter of 1982-83, it became apparent that the old barn was so full of holes it was no longer an adequate shelter. The roof had been patched, but was beyond fixing. So, in June of 1983, Warren, Tom, and John, with the help of Mark Weber, the Star Route driver, tore down the old barn. On July 21, 22, 25, and 26, 1983, the Morton Company erected a new barn. The new barn is beautiful, shiny, and efficient. The old barn was full of holes, and the roof leaked, but it had that special beauty that comes from long years of service, in all kinds of weather. The new barn comes with a 40-year guarantee. Grandpa George built the old barn with no guarantee, but it stood for 82 years, and housed untold numbers of horses, cows, sheep, hogs, kittens, and dogs. Four generations of Greshams worked and played within its walls. The new barn will be wonderful, but the old barn was full of memories, and we miss it.
Hello, can you hear?
The old Dittamore house. I remember the home of Jim and Bertie Dittamore, our neighbors to the south, that Mom always took special interest in, and always addressed her as Mrs. Dittamore. I can remember many times as a child, going there to visit. Mrs. Dittamore always had some kind of a goodie for us kids, that we enjoyed in the small kitchen. It was only seldom that we ever went into any other part of the house. The dining room was the room adjacent to the kitchen, and it was on a higher level, so there was one step to get into it. The room to the left of it was the living room, which had a front outside door, but it was seldom used, entrance was always through the kitchen. To the left of this was one or two bedrooms, not sure how many because I was never in it, or in them. I think probably two, because when I was still too young for school, there was a teacher there named Marietta Trout, and she boarded with the Dittamores. My dad helped Jim when he was needed. I remember once, when Jim had pneumonia, Dad milked his cows for him. I went with Dad, and can remember the old barn and the cows, and that some of the cows required chains on their legs in order to stop the kicking long enough to milk. I can't remember, but I suppose the milk was separated, and the cream sold to the creamery in Albert. There is a well there that is 250 feet deep, that was operated with a cylinder, and push rods powered by a one-cylinder John Deere gas engine. I know of at least two occasions that Dad helped pull the well, and replace the leathers in the cylinder. A dangerous job, with always the possibility of losing the pipe and having it fall to the bottom of the well. Fortunately, that never happened. Jim never owned a tractor, he always farmed with horses. He cut his oats with a binder, and stacked the bundles in a round stack from which the oats were forked into the threshing machine. The Dittamores were members of the Elbert Christian Church, and attended regularly. She loved to sing, very loudly and very off-key, but her praise was genuine and sincere. In 1937, Jim bought a new Plymouth four-door sedan. One Sunday, he took our family, and went to see my Uncle Elmer and Aunt Phyllis in Colorado Springs. He was not a good driver, but I was too young to realize that. My mother knew though, and she was scared to death the whole trip, both coming and going. We got home safe, and she breathed a sigh of relief. There is nothing left of the old place, except an old house. The barn has been gone for many years, and the land has been subdivided. There are many new houses now on the property, and some of the remaining property is severely infested with prairie dogs. The end of an era. Some of the memories from early childhood continuing to the time of Jim's death in 1959, and Bertie's in 1964. No one ever lived in that house again. May 5, 2020.
Hello, can you hear?
Memories from my youth. Being punished. I guess my dad was the disciplinarian when I was a kid. He was the one that always spanked us. He actually did it with a razor strap. He would always fold it over, so that when he used it there was very little energy actually imparted to your bottom. It made more noise than it did anything else. It made a lot of noise, and there was some pain associated with it, but it never hurt very much. Whenever things were not going right, he would threaten to get the razor strap, and usually that is all it took.
Sometimes when things got out of control, he would decide he had to use it, and he would do it. There was a time that I remember particularly. We had an old house on the place. Alan and I liked to play in and around that old house. One Sunday afternoon, we were playing at that old house, and Dad came around the corner just furious, and he picked us both up and paddled us. We had no idea why we were being paddled. He didn't have the razor strap that time. He used his hand. Come to find out, there had been some kerosene spilled on the floor of the basement. He kept kerosene down there that he put in the kerosene lamps that we used throughout the house. We had 4 or 5 of them, I guess. Somehow some of it got spilled down there. I don't remember today how it got spilled. I obviously knew at the time. Anyway, we didn't do it. Neither of us knew anything about it, but he thought we did, and so he was furious. As I look back, I can see why it bothered him so badly. I didn't know at the time how tough things were and how that kerosene was hard to come by. The cost of the kerosene was important to him. It wasn't the fact that there was kerosene on the floor, but that it was gone and couldn't be used in the lamp. I know now what his problem was, but I didn't then. I've often thought about the spanking we got. I can certainly understand his frustration, as suddenly the kerosene was gone. He may not have even had money in his pocket to go get more. I know many times he saw it that way.
Hello, can you hear?
My first 22. I have always had a fascination for guns, the sporting type, and especially the 22 caliber rifle. My dad shared this feeling with me, and used to tell me many stories about his hunting days as a boy at home. His younger brother loved to hunt, and the two of them must have spent considerable time at this pursuit. The 22 caliber rifle was a tool found in most farm homes. I know I grew up thinking of it as such. It was used to stun the animals that were butchered on the farm, as a 22 bullet in the head would render the animal unconscious, so that the throat could be cut and the animal would bleed properly, a very important part of home butchering. It was used to control the skunk population, especially when they decided to rob the chicken coop. An occasional coyote was felled with a 22 bullet also. I remember one time in particular, when my dad killed a coyote. My grandfather's 22 rifle was a Remington single-shot Model 6, with a falling block breech, and Dad had that gun at the time. He looked out the west window of the house one morning, and saw a coyote near the barn. He grabbed that rifle and just one cartridge, and ran out to take a shot. The coyote was about 75 yards below the barn when he got there. He fired and hit the coyote in the spinal cord, but didn't kill it. He started yelling at some of us kids to bring him some more ammunition. I ran out with a box of shells, this is an inaccurate term, but one my dad used all his life, and the excited man finished off the coyote. Dad had a 22 caliber WRF, single-shot bolt-action Springfield rifle. WRF stands for Winchester Rimfire. This rifle differed from the ordinary 22 long rifle in this way. The cartridge case is about 3/8 of an inch longer, and slightly larger in diameter. In the ordinary 22, the cartridge case is the same diameter as the body of the bullet. That part of the bullet seated in the cartridge is smaller by the thickness of the case wall. In the WRF, the case of the cartridge extends over the full 22 caliber bullet. Therefore, the cartridge chamber of the rifle is slightly larger and longer than the ordinary 22. The 22 Magnum, introduced in more recent years, uses the same design as the WRF, but the case is extended even more, making it longer than either the ordinary 22 long rifle or the 22 WRF. I used to dream of the day when I would have a 22 of my own, and once I did, I would hunt rabbits and coyotes, and most anything else that I could dream about. I longed for this and spent many an hour reading old sports magazines and thinking of the time when I would own a gun. My dad always told me that someday he would buy one for me. In 1945, the year I graduated from the 8th grade, I was hopeful that would be the year. I spent the summer hoping and dreaming that by fall, I would have a rifle of my own. I did get the rifle that year, and actually it came as a surprise to me, as it was earlier in the fall than I expected. I was sure that I would have to wait until after the beans were threshed, probably in October. It was not long after wheat harvest in August, when Dad took me into the local lumber company. He told me he saw this rifle in there the day before, and maybe we ought to go look at it. It was beautiful, and wonderful, exactly what I wanted. A Remington Model 511, a bolt-action repeater with a clip magazine that held 6 rounds. It would shoot 22 short, long, or long rifle ammunition. Dad bought the rifle that day. It cost $14.95, and I think he also bought me 2 boxes of long rifle ammunition that cost 39 cents per box.
It was certainly a happy boy that left the store that day, proudly carrying his new 22 rifle.
I hunted a lot with that rifle, and shot a lot of ammunition through it. I would not venture a guess as to how many rounds. I am fortunate to have all of these guns that I've mentioned in my collection today. I now own several other guns, and some of them are much better quality, and cost many times more money, but none are as important to me as the old Remington Model 511. One day, one of my grandchildren will own this rifle, depending, I suppose, where the interest is displayed, but I will not part with the rifle during my lifetime. I know what a sacrifice it was for my dad to come up with that $14.95. He knew how important that rifle was to me. It was an act of love that I shall never forget.